This week in Retronauts, every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. Hi everyone, it's me, Jeremy Parrish, and this episode is not closing time for Retronauts. No, it is about closing time for the Castlevania series, but the opening of a new chapter of Retronauts, a new book, as it were, if you will, yes. This is the first of what I hope will be a long series, a quarterly series potentially, of episodes called the Metroidvania Book Club. And we are not actually reading books. I mean, by all means, go for it. But it's, as many other podcasts have done, a play-along kind of situation where we are going to select a Metroidvania game and explore it in depth. Why Metroidvania, you say, Jeremy Parrish? Because you answered it right there, Jeremy Parrish. That's right. I am a Metroidvania sicko. And I have invited some of our other Metroidvania sicko friends to become regulars in this series and hopefully be able to participate in every episode that we do. And the idea is that with each game, we'll devote two episodes to that game and then move on to another game. And I would like for each person to have their turn selecting a game for us to explore. So it's not just me saying, here is what we should talk about, but rather each of the participants saying, here is the video game that best expresses my Metroidvania sicko-ness. And so hopefully we'll get a nice broad view of video games through a very specific genre lens, but lots of different tastes and interests within that space. And if not, well, the good news is there are five panelists here, but there is a sixth panelist, and that is you. That's right, gentle listener, you are the hero here. You are the sixth panelist. You are going to be participating in this, whether you like it or not. And that means that once the sixth topic comes around, you, the Retronauts community, will be selecting it. But it's going to be a while before we get there. Like I said, quarterly. So if we're all still alive in 2026, please look forward to it. In the meantime, here in 2025, we have, besides myself, Jeremy Parrish, a panoply of regular Retronauts sickos. Let's go over to the UK. Who's the sicko from the UK?
Gee, I wonder who it could be. It's me, Stuart Gipp. Hello. I didn't think of a joke for this one because it seems like we're doing something a bit more serious and analytical, and it would be inappropriate to do jokes. So no.
I mean, this is basically me saying, you know what? If Stuart can get away with five parts on Sonic 3, by God, I can do two parts on a Castlevania game. So how serious is that? This is Stuart Gipp calibrated, actually. So
really?
You are the measuring stick here. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel so honored.
Well, there you go. So Stuart, how much of a sicko are you for Metroidvanias? Where did you? This is Kate's. Oh, I spoiled it. Kate's suggestion. Where did you first fall in love with the Metroidvania genre?
I think I was probably kind of a late bloomer to it because the big games, the games that gave it its name, Metroid and Castlevania, the Symphony of the Night. It's not the Symphony of the Night, but I'm going to call it that to amuse myself. They didn't hit for me because I just didn't have a PlayStation. I didn't have a Super Nintendo. I didn't get to those games at all. And I think probably the first game like it that I played was Cave Story on the PC, which was free, of course, which helped a lot. But then later I played Aria of Sorrow. That was the first of these that I can recall playing. They're sort of proto Metroidvania-ish games like Wonder Boy, the Wonder Boy sequels on the Master System back in the day, but because they were divided into levels mostly, I don't really think of them, apart from Dragon's Trap, obviously, but I didn't have that. Aria of Sorrow, which, of course, for me means that Metroidvania is much more leaning in the Vania direction than the Metroid direction. That's where I had that experience first. Although through osmosis, I recognized things like the map is taken from Super Metroid, sort of codified that whole map thing, and or at least in that specific box by box, what's in this room, what's in that room manner. But from there, I loved Aria of Sorrow so much that it was just a matter of looking into everything that sort of came since then. I've actually, I'm going to get kicked off now, but I've actually kind of got fed up with Metroidvanias. So I've gone into a phase of, I've become more of a Luddite, and I just want to play stage-by-stage stuff, really. But then it's every so often a really cool one will come along, and like, I really like Bloodstained, mostly because it called back to games like this, obviously with the same director. But I wouldn't say I was that much of a Metroidvania sicko, but the ones I am a sicko for, like the Castlevania ones, I am deviant to the extreme.
Well, even if you lean toward the Vania side, you live not too far from London, so you can go take the train, and then you can play Vania on the metro. So that's kind of Metroidvania right there.
It's true.
It's bringing it all together.
Yeah, the only problem is you never get any upgrades, and the layout never changes.
That's true. But, you know, there is the exploratory element.
It's true, yeah. Mm-hmm. They get across to me when I knock the walls down, though. It's a problem.
And you probably don't want to eat the meat that you find there.
Oh, no, I eat the meat.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't care. Fair enough. All right, so I mentioned our next guest by name, so please introduce yourself and explain your sicko-tude regarding this genre.
Hey, I'm Critical Kate Willard. I am the sicko from Minnesota, which incidentally is where Semisonic the band is from. Random bit of trivia there. The closing times.
So that's like half of a Sonic the Hedgehog?
Yeah, I perked up.
Perked him, was disappointed.
So I got into Metroidvanias from Super Metroid, which was a huge game for me because I had never played a game before where exploration was like the main point, the main objective of a game. But for a long time, I was only a fan of like Metroid games then. Like when Metroid Prime came out, I was super into that. I did not play Zero Mission because I did not have a handheld until, I didn't own a handheld until like the 3DS era. And then for the longest time, I didn't even like backtrack. So I've played all
of
these.
What kind of Metroid player are you if you don't backtrack?
Exactly.
What is going on here?
I did eventually, though. I did go back and play all the 2D Metroid games, and I also, like, but before I did that, I should say, my introduction to the wider, broader genre of Metroidvania was actually Shadow Complex when that came out on the Xbox 360.
That
kind of, like, I was like, this is a whole genre. I should play more of these. But I missed out on like the most of the 2D Castlevanias, and I hadn't played those until, well, I bought the recent collections. I bought the collections, have not had an excuse to play them until now. Like this is the first one. The first one I've played. I don't know if that's a horrible introduction to it or not.
Well, we can talk about that. I think it's an interesting introduction. And in some ways it will all be downhill from here, but in other ways it will be kind of a relief. So, take that as you will. Let's see. From up in the, similarly frigid cold lands of the North, we have our Canadian panelist here calling in. Through a tariff-free connection, thank God.
For now.
They're not going to start charging for data, are they? Damn it.
Oh, God. I'm screwed. If they did. Anyway, I'm Nadia Oxford, frequent Retronauts contributor. Sorry about that. My first experience was actually, I don't know if you could call Simon's Quest a light Metroidvania, but that was when I kind of got the idea that, oh, I like these games that send me wandering, even if I have no idea what to do. And for a long time, I didn't really find anything like that, because I wasn't really big into Metroid, or I just didn't play it. I actually played Super Metroid for the first time when I got married, and my husband, like, brought over his copy, and I'm like, oh, this is actually a really good game. But before that, I played Symphony of the Night, because it was Castlevania, and so I'm expecting, oh, Castlevania, whippy whippy, you know, fun stuff. But then I see this completely different format once I got past the equally confusing Bloodlines opening. And at first I was like, this isn't what Castlevania should be, but I just kind of immediately got into the gameplay loop, so I just didn't care about the fact that it wasn't like traditional Castlevania. In fact, I think I prefer it to this day.
Hmm. All right. And finally, our hopefully a guest will be allowed to talk this episode, unlike the past few episodes he sat in on.
It's your dime, Jeremy.
That's true. You're calling collect.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. It's me, Chris Sims, full Metroidvania sicko. Also, in...
I know your favorite Metroidvania is Super Mario World. You've made that clear.
I did try to convince Jeremy that Super Mario World was a Metroidvania.
I admire how much
of a sicko I am.
I could buy into that if I was in the right mood.
It's got gear gating. It's got a permanent inventory. We'll get to it later.
I think you might be right.
I can't wait for your chapter.
I'm thinking about this now, and it's like the Galaxy Brain meme in my head.
Yeah.
Same.
I am also in the very Metroidvania-ish state of Minnesota, though it is not where I am from. And very, very kind of cliche, but it was Symphony of the Night for me. I can tell you exactly what day it was, because I had gone over to a friend's house to watch King of the Ring 1998.
Ah, nice.
And after... Mick Foley was thrown off the cell by the Undertaker.
My God, that man's broken in half.
We were still so hyped, we ended up staying up really late, and he had a PlayStation, and he had Symphony of the Night, and that was the first time I played it, and I was like, this is the best game that's ever been made.
That's quite a night for
you. So you went from, like, super brawny men to a very lithe, ethereal man?
I think Alucard's... There's a cloak, there's a heavy jacket, you don't know how jacked he is under there.
He's pretty jacked.
He's not the John Cena body with the Yoshisaka Amano head.
I'm not buying it, but
that's
okay.
Scary, but yes.
I'm a big, big Metroidvania fan. I'm sure I'll plug it at the end of the show, but I have a series of reviews that I've been writing of every Metroidvania that I have ever and will ever play. It is a genre that I have never gotten tired of, and specifically the Castlevania side. There was a time in my life where I would replay all of the Igavania, like Symphony of the Night to Ecclesia, every Halloween, like every October.
Cool.
That was Castlevania month for me.
Yeah.
Although I famously did not play Super Metroid until like 2019, I think. Like, we talked about it on the show.
I recall that.
That game's good.
Yeah, that was pretty great.
Super Metroid. Super Metroid's great.
It turns out.
You got to pace these things. I think that's a good idea. You know, you save the real big ones for like later in life, and then you got something to look forward to.
That was the big backtracking.
That's what I did with Earthbound. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's certainly been the case for me with the game we're talking about this episode, Castlevania Order of Ecclesia, or Order of Ecclesia, if you prefer. I don't actually know how it's supposed to be pronounced, and you can't look to the Japanese title for like a pronunciation guide, even though Japanese is phonetic, because the Japanese title is Akumajo Dracula Ubawareta Kokuin. So none of that sounds anything like Ecclesia.
What does it mean? Whatever. What does it translate to?
I don't know. I'm not...
You said it so personally.
Demon Castle Dracula, the Stolen Seal. There you go.
I mean, we knew the Demon cool. Castle Dracula part.
Okay, well, I'm just reading from Wikipedia, because that is the last known source of correct information in the world.
Ironically.
Yeah, used to be not. But anyway, I played this game back when it first came out and really bounced hard off of it, and had gone back a few times since then and bounced really hard off of it. And that is because it really front loads its difficulty.
It does.
In the sense that it's kind of got that Kid Icarus thing going on where it's really, really unforgiving at the beginning, and it expects you to play with very, very specific patterns and techniques until you start to level up, and then it sort of opens itself up. But it does not have a learning curve so much as just like, you know how they design pickup trucks now, where if you're like standing on the street, the pickup truck's hood is actually taller than your head? That's the difficulty curve on Order of Ecclesia. It's just an F-150 smashing into you by way of the Nintendo DS. And it's very painful.
The first boss you fight is very challenging. The giant skeleton. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it's a tough one to get past.
Yeah, we can talk about that. But it's one of those where the developers clearly play tested this a lot, and they watched people's strategies and patterns and said, let's program this little asshole to counter all of those strategies.
Yeah.
So everything that people do intuitively, we just give them the middle finger, and it causes them to lose horribly. Yeah. So it's a rough game. But, you know, I had to play it, literally had to play it in order to keep my job. So
what era was this?
This was this past year when the Dominus Collection came out, and I'd already done the hand-drawn maps for the Advanced Collection a couple years ago. And so obviously they said, oh, okay, well, we want the same thing in the Dominus Collection. And so, you know, the first two games, Portrait of Ruin and Dawn of Sorrow, no problem. Played those through many times. Order of Ecclesia, not so much. So yeah. I had to brace myself and get through. And then, you know, I found once I got past those kind of opening areas and I started to get better glyphs and started to have a better array of skills to make use of the systems and the elemental and typing, like with the weapons, you know, just had a broader array of abilities and options. It became very, very, it was always challenging, but much more accessible, and not so much like, wow, they expect me to do exactly one thing over and over again, but much more like, here's sort of like a challenge, and now I have three or four different ways that I can get around it. Let's see what seems like the most fun thing to do. So once you get past that sort of opening 2 hours or so, I think the game really opens up to you, at least to me. I can't speak about you, but so it took me, you know, more than 15 years to finally get around to finishing Ecclesia, but I did, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And you know, having gone back and replayed Portrait of Ruin and Dawn of Sorrow, I kind of feel like those games have a lot of sort of an underlying design issue, which is that they have zero friction to them, and they just feel like, I don't know, Portrait of Ruin especially, there's so much to the game. My God, I had to draw it all by hand. There's so much to that game. And it's just, you're just kind of cruising through. Like, there's nothing really memorable about most of the game. It's just like, here's content for you. Please enjoy content. And, you know, it's fun, but compared to Ecclesia, where everything feels much more carefully designed and managed and presented in a way that you can't just blast through it. You have to really think about what you're doing. I found that very engaging. I don't love how some of the bosses are they're tuned to be much more difficult than the rest of the game.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of that design philosophy of like, oh, well, you've gotten this far. It's been pretty easy so far. It's been manageable. Now you're going to have to replay this boss 8 times before you can finally take it down, and you have to use a specific pattern or a specific weapon. Please enjoy. Not a fan of that. Bloodstained, I still haven't played through because it does the exact same damn thing. But I'll get to it someday. I'm sure I'll have to do it for work or something. I don't know. Anyway, so that's my time with Order of Ecclesia. But we are going to talk about the game. And like I said, this is part of the Metroidvania Book Club. Like I mentioned, this was my selection for the book club, based on the fact that I finally beat this game and was like, I should do something with this time that I've invested into it.
I was really curious as to why you picked it to start with, especially given like that experience. Like, was this always the one that you were like, we're going to start with the final Castlevania game?
Well, I don't think we're just going to be playing Castlevania games for this series. I think it's going to be, it can be anything. I mean, if you want to make a case that Batman Arkham Asylum is a Metroidvania, which I think you'd have a pretty good case for, if you want to say Super Mario World, Chris, I'm going to let you do it.
Super Mario World is more of a Metroidvania than Arkham Asylum. I'll say
What I'm saying is that if you can make a case for it, we'll do it. So I feel like, ideally, we're going to cover a broad range of games. And so, one, yes, I did just recently play through Order of Ecclesia for the first time to completion. But two, it's really damn good. And it does a lot of things that I'm really sad that the Castlevania series went away after this, because if they had built on the strengths of this game, I can't imagine where they could have gone on like 3DS. It sure would have been better than Lords of Shadow for that, you know, that bad 3DS.
They would
game.
Have made Bloodstained.
They would have, yeah, but
that's a thing that really got to me about this playthrough, because I haven't replayed Ecclesia in a while, like Ecclesia, since, you know, kind of the end of the DS era. It was shocking to me how much it is a direct line from Ecclesia to Bloodstained, which I knew in my head but didn't know in my soul.
I mean, Bloodstained is a sequel to this game in everything except name. Like, they change the characters' names, and you're not fighting Dracula, it's some other guy. But it is Order of Ecclesia 2, just straight up. No question about it. And, you know, that's fine. That actually makes me want to go back and finally play it when I have some time. But for now, I just want to make use of the many hours I spent with this game last year, because let me tell you, hand drawing all those maps, it's time consuming. I got to know this game very intimately.
Did you draw like all the different sort of disparate areas and the castle? Because then, like, the straight line ones must have been at least a small relief to map.
Yeah, the two straight line ones. I mean, I embedded a tiny thumbnail of the front side of the map, the world map part of it, into the notes that I put together for this episode, so you can refer to it there. It's got all the little boss characters. It's going to be almost unreadable at the size that it's printed, but that's not my fault. I didn't make those maps so dense. That's on Konami. But anyway, where I was going with this was, this was my selection, and we're going to talk about this game in two halves. We're going to talk about the overworld and just kind of the systems and everything this episode. And then next episode, we'll get to the back half of the game, which is Dracula's Castle. And we're also going to open up comments from listeners. Very specifically, we are going to have a space in our Retronauts Discord, which patrons have access to, where you can talk about your thoughts on this game and then subsequent Metroidvania Book Club entries. So please look forward to that. Please enjoy this episode. It's a spoiler zone, be aware, but it's okay because you're going to play this game and enjoy it with us and then share your thoughts in Discord. And it's going to be cool. It's going to be a good time. We are going to talk about fighting some Draculas. Actually, there's just one. All right, so Castlevania, Order of Ecclesia. This game came out in 2008. I've explained where I played it for the first time, which was back then and also very recently. And Kate, I believe you said you played it for the first time in the Dominus Collection, but what about all you other folks?
I got the game when it first came out because I am a big Igavania head. And I think I did eventually end up finishing it, but I had problems with the bosses because there is a boss that's like trying to emulate Shadow of the Colossus, which was like,
oh god, yes, yes.
Yeah, so I was just
Eligor.
Is that the big horse guy thing?
The centaur guy, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, I just had a problem with the way the bosses were balanced. I don't know if this is the place to start talking about balance issues or if you want to hang on to that for later in the episode.
We'll hold on to that, but
definitely, like, I don't hate the game by any means. I don't say it's a terrible game. It's good. It's a great game in many respects, but I feel like maybe it took... You're absolutely right about there being the friction that this game, that this series really needed by that point. But I also think that they took certain things from Portrait of Ruin that worked really well there and just tried to dissect it even more and make it new. And it didn't really work out in the end. But yeah, we'll get into that, I'm sure. So I'm very middle of the road on Ecclesia.
I'm actually curious to hear what you mean by that.
Oh, right now?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I feel like Portrait of Ruin had the Jonathan Charlotte to kind of get those different styles mixed into the gameplay. This game has that weapon system that's generally like, okay, swords, maces, maces against skeletons, swords against fleshy things, et cetera, et cetera. And it really rides that hard. Whereas in Portrait of Ruin, it was very easy to switch between Jonathan and Charlotte. It was fun to hear them yell at each other. But in this game, I have a problem holding down A and shifting and remembering what my loadouts are. And the names are all in Latin, which I'm stupid. I'm sorry. I don't remember what anything means. So I do have some problems with there being too much of the wrong kind of friction. But we'll talk more about that, I guess.
Yeah, so Expecto Patronus is the one that... We're not allowed to joke about that series anymore. Reference it at all. No, I agree. Like that weapon loadout switching system was actually present in Dawn of Sorrow. You could just like tap X.
I didn't need
switch.
It so much.
Cycle.
So like this game is very. We'll get into that. Okay.
Yeah, that's the thing is like this game wants you to do that. It really requires you to do that. But instead of giving you a single button to swap out the loadouts,
right.
like Dawn of Sorrow did, it's this weird button combo and it's not intuitive. Like why did they do that?
It's not, no.
My old knobbly hands could not remember. I couldn't, like, I don't have the capacity for muscle memory anymore.
No, me either. I was pressing R before I was pressing A and that would make me do a stupid attack. And it's like, yeah. If it was just like, R or press the control pad or something, it'd be easier, but I still have a problem remembering, like, you have three slots in each loadout. Don't remember what's where. Again, we're all old. We're all, where's my teeth? So we're going to have trouble with these loadouts.
Not to be a modern gamer about it, but also the game doesn't tell you anything about the damage types. And, you know, I don't need I don't necessarily need hey, Shinoa, did you know that you can use a bludgeoning weapon against skeletons? But, like, I only remembered that was a thing because it's a thing in D&D.
It's a thing in Dark Souls and everything.
Yeah, it expects you to have played Dungeons & Dragons or Vagrant Story or something that has that element to it.
Vagrant Story.
And that was something that took me a while to kind of catch on to because Castlevania had never really done that before.
Right.
Like, you had elemental stuff. Yeah, you know, a mummy, throw fire at it, it's going to burn. Better than, like, you know, an ice demon will. But the weapon affinity is just not something that you really saw in the Castlevania games over the course of more than 20 years of games. So it just took me a little while to kind of clock to the fact that, oh, yeah, actually, it's doing this RPG thing that's never happened before in Castlevania, and no one actually in the game, like, there's no indication that that's the case. You just have to kind of watch the damage you're doing. But in the early stages of the game, you have so few weapon types that you don't really have the capacity to swap and experiment with the weapons and or glyphs and say, oh, this one's much better. Oh, I'm seeing a pattern here. It's a rough start.
You have to learn on your feet. Yeah.
That's interesting to me because, like, coming to this first of all the Castlevania handheld games, I was like, Am I totally lost because this is assuming I'm an expert Castlevania person who has picked up all this knowledge across like six games or whatever? And
no, it was gaslighting you.
Yeah, it was the first time where Castlevania's designer said, maybe people play other games besides Castlevania. Right, and that was unexpected because we don't.
It's interesting to me because like there's a divide there coming off of Aria, Dawn, and Portrait, which they're all, I mean, I love those games, but like once you get a weapon that's a higher number, you just use that weapon then on, really. And the things that you get, like the spells or the souls, they're cool, but you find the cool ones that work, and then you just use those again. You don't really mess around with them that much, I mean, just, other than to use them and go, hey, that's cool looking. Yeah. But in this game, it's all of a sudden, it's like, you'd hit an enemy with what you think is your strongest weapon. It will do one damage, and you'll be like, well, shit. And then you might not even have the right glyph to do the damage you need to do. You might have to go and find it somewhere or absorb it even from like an enemy or something. And it's just going from this kind of, I mean, Portrait of Ruin, which a game I absolutely love. And even though I clearly recognize that it's just a big nostalgia, like a nostalgia fest of, hey, remember this stuff? But I loved it. And coming from that to this quite recently, well, for this as well, was just this kind of, oh yeah, I forgot this game is really, really difficult. And the thing is, I don't know if it's really super hard. It's just super punishing. Like you can't take many hits in this game. You can't really defend yourself.
Enemies are sponges too.
You can't buy health up items until you've done missions in the game. Yeah. Like there's no reliable way of healing even. It's and it makes it a lot more punishing, and I think having bite-sized levels is a nice concession to that initially, but it's interesting how it's kind of odd playing it even as a fan or even playing it as someone who's playing it for the first time. You're going to run into the same walls, which I guess is the great sort of level in that, this respect.
You get you just go into a level and all of a sudden the Undertaker's kicking my ass. Like, it's
turning
just
fully just the Undertaker.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
Totally stop the damn match.
It's really funny.
This game reminds me of... Oh, go ahead.
Like you were saying, previous to this, it's like the different types of weapons. They had different functionality, like, you know, whether it was attack speed or the type of area they hit or something like that. But it does become it's much less of an aesthetic choice in this one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Which is a pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of the flaws in this, like you mentioned Stuart, I think the lack of healing items, like that's straight out of Circle of the Moon, but that was a different Castlevania team. Yeah. Like of all the things to bring back, why that one? I mean, there are healing items,
yeah,
but to get them, you have to unlock them in the shop. And then once you do unlock them, the good ones are very, very expensive. So you have to figure out some sort of cash exploit so you can actually afford them.
It also adds an interesting layer of exploration within the items, because I discovered that the Killerfish Barbecue is very good for healing you and is much cheaper than a super potion and can be farmed, which is just, it's not intuitive, but it also makes you feel kind of smart when you figure that out, like you've sort of got one over on the game. And you need to be smart to finish this. There's a lot of, almost every screen is incredibly threatening. There's no breathers. It's like everything can kill you. It's like Dark Souls. Sorry. But it is.
It is. I have to admit.
Dark Souls is a huge Castlevania ripoff.
It's even got the stamina thing. When you attack, it's even got the stamina.
No, I think we just need to make peace with the fact that Dark Souls is just a giant Castlevania ripoff, and it owes everything to Castlevania. So it's totally fine to make the comparison, because we know that this is what inspired Dark Souls. But the mention of the fact that when you enter a new area, something is going to like immediately go after you and destroy you.
Yes.
Really reminds me of the DS remake of Final Fantasy IV.
Yes.
Which was built around, I think, the same sort of thinking, that we're making this, you know, for people who are fans of the series, who have their ways of play, who kind of know what to expect. And we want to shake them out of their complacency. We want to surprise them. We want to give them something that's really difficult and force them to, you know, instead of just kind of breezing through all these familiar spaces and just kind of subsist on comfortable familiarity, to really have to stop and think, whoa, what do I do now? Which is how Castlevania used to be back in, you know, like the 8-bit days. So I can admire it in that respect, but it just feels like, you know, there's no kind of boundary between breezing through Portrait of Ruin and starting up Order of Ecclesia and just getting utterly annihilated by
everything
on the screen.
Yeah, because Final Fantasy IV DS, it made itself very clear from the start what it is. And this is a game where, you know, by then Final Fantasy IV was ingrained in your heart. So you go to the Antlion cave and say, I'm going to use magic on this guy because otherwise he'll counter me. And this time you use magic and he counters you because they're just being dicks about it. But that's the fun of it. Whereas, as you say, with Ecclesia, it's going from a very jovial looking, frankly, game to kind of a darker game where everything kicks your ass. And like I said, the Undertaker keeps trying to kill you. I actually ran into the Undertaker to see if he would tombstone me, but he didn't.
Oh, that's a shame.
So much damage.
I died very quickly.
He does so much damage.
I feel like this was kind of a thing that developers were doing with sort of legacy series at the same around this time, because you also had Mega Man 9, which was very much designed around, hey, people know how Mega Man works. They've been playing it for 20 years, but what if everything they did we accounted for and we effed them up by countering that? Like, oh, I love 9 because every time I just kind of like, you know, slid into it and was like, oh, I know what's going to happen. It was clearly designed by people who had watched people like me play the games and said, I know how this guy thinks. I've watched him live stream. You know, I've watched him, you know, play drunk at Tokyo gaming bars and just kind of work through the patterns. So let's add these new twists in here. You know, the skeleton in the prison in Order of Ecclesia is exactly the same as like some of the, like the platforms. I think it's in, Splash Woman stage where you jump and you think you're going to be able to land on it. Oh no, Crystal Man stage, I think. And it just like swings out of the way at when you least expect it. And you have to totally approach it a different way so you don't fall into a pit and die.
Yeah.
So yeah. And like the, you know, the magic counter system or, you know, Dr. Luge in Final Fantasy IV, who now attacks you with poison gas if you do a certain thing.
Yeah.
So I feel like this was an attempt by the people who are responsible for these aging franchises to say, we need to freshen this up. We need to change how people experience it. And also, I think kind of a way to get back to the roots of gaming, you know, from the 8-bit era, where games tended to be unforgiving and punishing. And the people who fell in love with series like Castlevania or Mega Man, like, they memorized those experiences and they learned, you know, the muscle memory I have, it was all spent on Castlevania and Mega Man and Mega Man 2. Like, that's where it all went. I don't have it anymore. It's like, you know, I used up all my juice, my memory juice. So, you know, I think it was an attempt to kind of, to sort of commune with that spirit of game design, which was very different than overall game design thinking in the 2000s, where it was very much like,
much more accessible.
You bought a video game? Here you go. We're going to give you little ammo caches. Enjoy. Here's an hour and a half of tutorial. Please enjoy. Thank you. It just,
yeah,
you know,
I hate those games that want you to have fun.
If I have fun when I'm playing a game for even 1 second, I lose my mind.
It stops being fun when they're nagging you about, like, you know, here's what happens when you pick up a rupee 12 hours into the game. Yes, I know. It's 50 rupees. Wow, I can buy so much. Thank you, Link. Thank you. I'm aware.
You know what? There's probably like one guy out there who had forgotten and was like, oh, thank God.
Oh, thank God.
That's what this is.
It's one rupee. Okay. Green means one.
I feel like Ecclesia, I'm going to call it Eccles Cake because of the village of Eccles. Order of Ecclesia is like, for me, it's, I feel like this is a bit of a trite thing to point out, but it's kind of, it's subversive, isn't it? They're subverting everything for the sake of it, really. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's even down to like, you go into, you've got these, segmented sort of, levels, so to speak, which are mini Metroidvania maps in and of themselves when they're not straight lines. And, what you'll be thinking, okay, I start here, I go to the end, I fight the boss, we move on. And then you go to into a map and the boss will be the first thing that you encounter and be followed by the rest of the stage. And it's just, even in the little things like that, it's trying to get, what's the word, wrong foot you. And I find it kind of intoxicating because, I do like games that are fun. Don't get me wrong. I like being given lots of infinite ammo and stuff. I do. I love that. But also I think it's really fun when a game gets you and goes, ah, and this game does that several times in places that I don't want to mention yet because they're more back half of the game. There's some, like all the, I'm talking all the way down to the final boss. This game will make you think something's going to happen and then something else will happen that's much cooler.
Do you remember when Iga, I believe there was a video of Iga making a level in Mario Maker.
Oh god.
And he put the boss first. Or something
that's
like
that.
That's
a very Iga move.
But if I'm Dracula, why am I putting my weakest guys out first? I'm putting Death and Gallimoth in the opening hallway, because I don't want to get whipped to death by a Belmont or sliced to pieces by my son.
Putting Gallimoth in the start of Symphony, that's the end of the game right there. It's done.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, if I'm Dracula, I want to win.
But it's your kid, you know?
Yeah.
It's a fraught relationship.
You want him to grow.
Like that. Yeah.
It is fraught.
This is definitely the most difficult of the, I would say, of the Egovanias by far, because the other ones are very prone to, well, I say prone to like it's an accident. They let you break them, and that's fun. You know, they let you get great items early on the game, and just, like Gallimoth, when I fought Gallimoth, I had some armor that meant he was doing 1 HP damage to me. I don't know how I managed it. Something dropped it. I don't know. And I'm like, that's the hardest
boss. There's a barrel ring that absorbs lightning.
Yeah, and I think I just had it without even knowing what it was, and I'm just like, oh, that's the hardest boss in the game? And I didn't even like that game until I discovered it again later and went, oh, I see, yeah, this is brilliant. But with Order of Ecclesia, I think to compare it to Bloodstained a little bit, sorry, it's interesting because Bloodstained is definitely a fusion of like Ecclesia and the previous two games because they did sand the edges down a bit. It's still difficult.
Yeah, for sure.
But they wanted to make it more accessible. And as much as I love Bloodstained, when they did that, they took some of the character out. Like, this game has character oozing out of its pores. Like, there's so much bespoke stuff in this game that, as well as the sprite, like, rips from the old games, yes, but there are so many new weird enemies and new weird areas, like the skeleton cave. There's imaginative stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, the cave
and
of skeletons.
And even little things, like the prison when you get caught by the spotlight and you, a little robot comes out and just murks you in one hit.
Oh, the Tin Man. That thing's
and you can't do anything to it. And then later you get caught by another spotlight and you're like, uh-oh, here comes the robot. And Freddy Krueger's friggin' head flies onto the screen.
I like, and he has the tongue thing, by the way, I noticed.
It's horrible and brilliant.
I do feel like there's something to be said for the idea of this being thematic, in that everyone in every protagonist of a Castlevania game is having a bad time to various extremes. But I feel like Shinoa is having a uniquely bad time.
Oh, she's really
like,
going through
she's
it.
She's very disempowered at the beginning of that game. So the idea that you start off really overwhelming and you don't really get much of a break until like after you meet Albus the first or second time. Like, it makes sense. It's like, wow, yeah, that it sucks. It sucks to have lost your memory of how to do things.
It's definitely really cohesive with the themes, I think. That's what makes this one stand out so much, is how everything just comes together so well. Even little things like I'm really sorry, but I've forgotten the name of the artist they brought back, I think, from the older games.
They
instead
didn't,
of using
no.
the anime portraits. Even that is like, oh, hey, we're back, you know?
They actually did not. The original illustrator was Ayami Kojima.
Yes.
And the artist on this one is Masaki Hiroka.
Oh, apologies.
So it's a different artist. It's kind of the same vibe, but his men are not nearly as pretty as Kojima's men. Like, she draws beautiful human beings, just otherworldly beautiful. And everyone in Order of Ecclesia is a little more grounded, a little more mundane.
I've noticed that the men and the women, like, both they have the same faces. They like the character portraits.
It's kind of like the Yoshitaka Amano thing. Everyone is just sort of beautiful and drawn in a very distinctive way.
I do like that Shonoa's characteristic of not being able to feel emotions does just make her seem tired.
Yeah, she gets
every
me.
Time she shows up.
Okay, you want this? Fine, I'll get you your ore.
Yeah, whatever. How many ores?
Three, okay. Fine.
All right.
Kate, I think you were going to say something.
Oh, I was just going to ask Stuart, like, based on your point that, like, there's all this friction, but it's also got some of, like, the most character in terms of these creative ideas. Like, do you feel those are connected? That, like, the creative ideas, like, maybe they just went for these creative ideas that they might have normally shot down for the sake of, like, this would be too difficult, or...
I do feel like there's a sense of we're going for broke with this game. Like, this is the last one. I think they know it's the last one. I mean, the only one after this was the Harmony of Despair, which is just it's a great game, but it's not a proper Castlevania like this is.
I think there was also Judgment. Or did that come before this?
Oh, yeah.
Judgment came after this because Shinoa's in it.
Yeah. I think it linked up with it, didn't it, actually? Yeah.
Probably.
That's
non-canon.
I know what you mean.
Well, we've come back to Death Note again. Yeah.
It all comes back to Death Note.
All according to plan.
Yeah. But no, I do think that there is. I mean, I don't think I'd be able to express it that well because me no smart. But when you are facing off against sort of the odds that you're facing in this game, and obviously the character is facing off against tremendous odds at the same time, it makes it cohesive and it puts you in there with them. Maybe you're not completely sort of cognizant of it while you're playing it, but there's so much about the game that's odd and different. If you've played the previous ones, you're going to be, there's almost nothing it's like they've gone, we need to do the exact opposite of what we did here. We need to, even like Dracula's castle is full of just unusual areas that you haven't seen before in the previous games. And it does feel very much like they're going for broke. I don't know how much money they had to make this, but it doesn't feel cheap because there's a lot of more new art in this game than there is in something like Portrait of Ruin, right? Like, or at least less reuse of enemies, less reuse of sprites. A lot of the normal sort of recurring bosses don't show up, and if they do, they're very drastically different.
Well, something that this game does is recycle its own assets a lot. If you look, this is something, you know, again, I can speak about intimately. Every map area in the overworld is matched by sort of an equivalent space that has a similar structure, uses a lot of the same graphical assets, but, you know, there's some new element to it, some new gimmick, but there's like two water areas and two rocky mountain passes and two woods.
Two misty woods. Yeah.
Yeah. So
not dissimilar to Portrait of Ruin, reusing the portraits towards the end of.
Right. No, I mean, it's very similar, but it feels a lot more meaningful here. But someone mentioned something about Iga designing a Mario Maker level. And so I do want to think back to the time that I interviewed Iga about Portrait of Ruin at E3. And I said, you know, Dawn of Sorrow to me feels like especially once you beat it and you open up the extra mode where you play as the trio of heroes, it really feels like you were trying to remake Castlevania 3 in a way. Have you ever thought about remaking Castlevania 2? And he was like, no, I don't like that game. It's the villagers are too mean. Like, they always lie to you. I don't like it. So I was like, oh, okay. Now that I've played Castlevania Order of Ecclesia, this game is Castlevania 2 as a Metroidvania.
Yeah.
And Chris, I know you have thoughts about this, but I mean, the thing that kills me is they clearly designed the overworld of this game as a single contiguous space. And at some point in development, probably very late, they broke it into individual areas. So when you exit, you go to the world map instead of just going on to the next space, which really changes the feel of the game from Castlevania 2, which is just like, here's this vast space that you have to traverse. But the thing that kills me is they didn't rearrange the levels to accommodate this or account for it. So you have a lot of stages where you have warps and exit or save rooms right at the entrances mm-hmm. of the stage yeah. and then nothing in the middle, which doesn't make any sense if you have this world map system where you can just duck out to the world map and save the game on the world map two screens away from the save room. But it does make sense if the entire game is one contiguous Castlevania 2 style world where the only time you ever see the world map is when you go to a warp room and you choose to warp around and you need the save points because you have to save progress as you're exploring. I feel like I would love to play the version of Order of Ecclesia where everything is just linked together. I feel like that would not be a difficult ROM hack as ROM hacks go. Like, I've seen some pretty heavily invested ROM hacks in my time. And I feel like changing the pointers for this screen when you exit it, what does it do? Does it take you to the world map? No, it takes you to this next level. And, you know, having drawn out the entire world map for Castlevania Order of Ecclesia, I got to put down all the maps that I drew. And let me tell you, it all links up great. It makes one big space that you could explore with, you know, kind of like multiple paths through it, just like Castlevania 2. Iga, what did you do? Who made you do this, Iga? Was it Konami?
He told me that he liked Castlevania 2. I don't know where this discrepancy come from.
Iga's deceptive.
He is.
He's a sly bastard.
That Castlevania Symphony Night wouldn't have happened without 2. So, but then again, he didn't say he loved Castlevania 2, just like he used it as an idea for Konami so that he could say, hey, this is what I have in mind.
I feel like that was the idea here. But Chris, I would be curious to hear your thoughts on this question if I haven't just, you know, stolen your rant from you.
If I had to guess, and who can fathom the mind of Koji Igarashi, but I would guess that he feels about Castlevania 2 very similarly to the way I feel about it, which is that it is a game that's reach exceeds its grasp. What I wrote down is that Order of Ecclesia is the fulfillment of a 21-year-old promise. Castlevania 2 is a bad game. It's not a good game. It's not fun to play. It's counterintuitive. It is intentionally a hassle to get through on very basic levels. It's not a good game. It is a game a decade ahead of its time. It's a game that's like trying to make an action RPG before either of those things really exists. And I think there's a lot of respect that I have for it because of that. Like, I love contiguous worlds and leveling up and RPG mechanics and getting new weapons and day-night cycles and all that stuff that's in Castlevania 2, but bad. So getting this as what is feels very consciously like a sequel to Castlevania 2 specifically, in a way that so many of the Game Boy Advance and DS era games are specifically sequels to Symphony of the Night, because they know they have to put a second castle in there, or else you're going to be disappointed because everybody loves that second castle in Symphony of the Night. This one goes back And I remember I was talking about Castlevania 2 back when this game came out. And I was talking about Castlevania 2, and I was like, yeah, it doesn't have a castle in it. It's bad. Castlevania game, no castle. That's just Vania. That's bad. Yeah. And somebody was like, yeah, well, I like Order of Ecclesia, and I'm pretty far into the game, and it doesn't have a castle yet. And I was like, you're not as far as I am, Buster. Because I think it does, in the way that Castlevania 2 wants you to explore this world and talk to people, it does build that anticipation for getting to the fireworks factory. You know, like, it gets you to Dracula's castle that, for all the fact that, you know, there's two forests and two water places and two mountain passes, etc., that version of the castle, which we will be getting to later, has a lot of really unique visuals in it that don't look like previous versions of it. So the process of getting there, I have always thought, is really a fulfillment of what Castlevania 2 wanted to do, but simply was impossible at the time.
And I agree with all of that, except that Castlevania 2 is a bad game, which is not correct.
It's not fun to play.
But the thing is that I feel like this would have been even more immersive if they hadn't broken up the world map.
Agree.
You have the warp points in there. You don't need to go to the world map every single time you run to the edge of the stage. You could just go to the warp points that are very well placed throughout the game as, you know, kind of progress markers. If you have a contiguous space, it's such a bummer, because I do feel like this is, you know, missing that one element of immersion that could have made it even better than it already is. And, you know, looking at the maps and just laying them out and dreaming about, oh, what could have been, kind of kills me. Cause that's what I'm here for. I didn't talk about how I got into Metroidvanias because I've, like, go listen to literally any other episode of Retronauts over the past 20 years. You'll hear it. But, I mean, Metroid is what got me into the first NES game that I bought, and just kind of made me say, like, this is how I'm calibrating my expectations of video games. It needs to be this. I want to get lost and explore a place, and I want a world that draws me in. And this has that. And then they're like, here you go. Have a little bite-sized piece. Here's your forest sample. Here's your snack-sized mountain pass. No, I want it all together. I want the buffet.
I get where you're coming from. Like, and I think it's a completely valid complaint to have if that's what you're after. I think if they had done that, I'd still love the game. But that would be the sixth time in a row that they'd done that exact thing. And I don't blame them for doing... Well, it would be, you know, the big contiguous map is something that they'd had Symphony of the Night, they'd had the three GBA games, two DS games. And that's, I guess, you know, if that's what you're here for. I mean, Portrait of Ruin is already leaning in a way towards this with the portraits, which are much bigger maps. But what they're doing here, I think, is something like comparable to Portrait of Ruin, which is they are doing nostalgia, but they're doing it less overtly. And because of the change of the structure, while it does make it a more fragmented thing, it also gives you one of the all-time great reveals, which is the castle. Sorry for the spoilers, everyone. Because I didn't know there was a castle in this game when I played it, and I played it on import because it took forever to come out over here. And I went through the whole thing. I was the only one playing it. And when I got to the castle, I was just like, no, you know, you gotta be kidding me. That's crazy. Like, I've just done this long, it's not even easy, long ass game that took me forever to get through. I've done like 8 boss fights. I've beaten up Barlow, I've beaten up Albus, and now we've got so much more game left. There's like another, I wouldn't say it's another 50%, but like a good 33, you know,
kind of an upside down castle moment almost.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's almost cooler than the upside down castle in a way. And it's also another subversion, because rather than a second castle or a second side to the same castle, it's just like, no, there's a castle. That's the surprise.
It's in the title. You get it.
Yeah. But I think what they did here is really cool. I like the way that the levels sort of do intersect with each other in a sense, in the way that you can almost, in a Mario World way, sometimes you can find secret exits from the areas that lead to mm-hmm. other areas. And when I discovered, it's late game, so I won't say it actually, but the stuff that you can stumble across and be like, okay, so this is an entrance to this area.
What's down here in this basement? In. Oh my god!
Yeah, or like the underwater stages, which have the sort of wrecked ship above them that you can enter from various different angles and get to where you need
that's
to go quicker.
Cool.
And I respect, like, I think, yeah, it's definitely an immersion break, but it's got a purpose as well. And for me, it also gives you that nice home base feeling of going back to the village to get hearts and to save. It makes that fake place feels like home. Because everything sure. you need is there.
But you could still have that if you warped back to the village from a warp point. The thing that gets me is that Castlevania hadn't had a contiguous world, just a castle, since Castlevania 2. And that's still what makes Castlevania 2 kind of a unique entry in the series, is that it feels like, you know, in that game, you're Simon Quest is a different game. You are Simon on his quest, and you're out there. You know, no one likes you. Everyone's lying to you. The world is hostile. They're telling you to put laurels in your soup, but actually you need them to survive the swamp. It's, you know, it's challenging and it's indifferent to your existence, basically. And then, you know, reach the castle and there's nothing there. But this could have been the realization of that. You know, there is this big indifferent world, but people are nice to you. They give you quests and they'll sell you potions. And they're like, hey, thanks for saving my kid. Now you can have cool armor. And, you know, at the end of that, you reach the castle and it's not just a basement where you burn Dracula. It's much, much more than that. Yeah. I just feel like, you know, it was almost there. Castlevania hadn't really committed to the bit in terms of like, hey, Transylvania is a big place. In a long time. And you know, some of the level-based games did that. Dracula X or Rondo of Blood, Super Castlevania 4, Castlevania 3. There's a lot of, like, build-up to get to the castle. And
yeah,
then
even
you get
in
to
3,
the castle, but
you had that split path. Like, do you take the forest or do you go on the ship? And, you know, the difficulty really depended on which direction you went in. Not to say it was ever easy. But.
And I want that, but, like, as just one space that I have to figure out. And, you know, the thing that really kills me about Portrait of Ruin is that breaking up the individual paintings like that, I think, really undermines the individual stages, the spaces, because there's no reason to return to them except like, oh, I have to go find a spell that will allow me to get to like the final room or whatever. But there's no reason to go back and revisit the spaces because you just kind of clear through them your first time through. And it doesn't feel like, hey, there's real persistence and, you know, there's no real reason to learn stuff. It's cool that in the academy, there's like a room where there's, you know, a toilet stall and a ghost is like sitting there and then they vanish. Like, what does that mean? That's interesting and intriguing, but it just doesn't feel like beyond those little breadcrumb, like, hey, here's a little bonus weird thing in Portrait of Ruin, that the spaces have any real substance or purpose. And I feel like when you create a large space that has interconnected crisscrossing paths, then it just makes the place feel more real and gives it much more of a sense of presence and of like, hey, this matters. I need to learn this place. I need to figure out the ins and outs of this place because I'm not just blowing through it. I'm actually kind of soaking in it. And this is a place I'm going to be experiencing many times over. I don't know. I like that. I like places.
The toilet ghost incident reminds me, it sounds like I don't know if I'd call it an upgrade, I don't know what I'd call it, but it sounds like it's a tribute at least to the fact that in Symphony of the Night you have that crying ghost in the confessional who's probably Alucard's mother, or so the theory goes. I just love there's an analog to it in, you said it was Portrait of Ruin, I think, and it's just a toilet ghost. It's just funny.
I think that's more of like one of those there's like five or six different Japanese yokai that involve toilets. I think it's more of a reference to that. But, you know, it's probably a throwback to Symphony of the Night too.
I'm of two minds about the whole map thing, because I totally see your point, and now I do wish I could see it all as one. When I looked at your map, actually, I was like, hey, did you try to fit these together? And maybe that should have been the map. And now you're saying like, oh, you could do that. Like, so I almost want to see that now. But at the same time, when I was playing this, I was like, I liked the idea of these locations, but I felt like they were each like too small. Like I like the idea. Mm-hmm. When I play Metroidvania games, I fall into this trap where I always love the very beginning. And then once it gets too complex, I start to get overwhelmed. And I was like, oh, what if there was a game where it was like 9 different, like, beginnings of a Metroidvania that, you know, like you gain a few different upgrades in each and then you complete it and go to the next one. And then maybe there's some final thing that brings them all together or I don't know what, but I feel like that is, like some sort of unexplored potential that somebody needs to try at some point.
It's like Dragon Quest IV, but as a Metroidvania.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just thinking of Arabian Nights on the Amiga now, but we don't talk about the Amiga on these podcasts.
I do like the idea of more people being like, what if we just made the good parts of a game?
Yeah.
What if we made a Mario where he never went in the water?
I love Mario water.
But there's so much Metroidvania potential when you start swimming around the water, Chris.
There is.
That's
true.
Yeah,
this one's full of water, this old river Ecclesia.
It is. Those are some of the best and most explorable spaces.
Yeah.
They are fun.
I wonder how much of the division of the world is a concession to the fact that it was a DS game and that a lot of those games were made to close your DS and finish your bus ride or whatever.
Can I interject? Because you're absolutely right. I mean, I was thinking that I wonder if the reason why the sense of place becomes less kind of paramount and less interesting to move through is because with Symphony of the Night, there's so much detail in that game. Every single screen, there's something to look at all the time. Even when you're traveling through, you might notice some new interesting thing. You see some weird little object that they've just put in there for the love of it. And in these games, they can't really do that. It's not, I mean, there is detail, there is a kind of appeal, but it's more, a lot more rooms that, and I apologize for using this, but a lot more copy pasting, like even in Order of Ecclesia, of different rooms just become challenge rooms. And it means that the games focus a lot more on the systems, because that becomes sort of all that's left when you don't have the fascination with the world. And that's not me saying this sucks. That's me saying this aspect of it has not been prioritized. I mean, Portrait of Ruin is like, I mean, they're not good maps in that game. Which is why they front load, look, you can do this and this and get this and find this and everything. This drops like 6 different things and oh my Christ, what the hell's going on? because they're distracting you from that by making it so systems led. And Order of Ecclesia is even more so. It's just like, you're going to have to think about even your attacks are going to be alternating between 2 buttons to get decent damage output. And then when you're having to do that, when you're having to focus on not dying all the time, it doesn't really matter so much that the places you're in maybe aren't as cool as they could be, because that's not what's engaging you. I just feel like there's definitely a deliberate sort of lean away from that part, but also it's a restrictions thing. They just can't do it the same way they could with Symphony.
Right.
So they change it.
I would say that Order of Ecclesia is the only post-Symphony Castlevania game that actually feels like as much thought was put into the environmental spaces as in Symphony. Like I feel like there's always something new and interesting. And maybe you don't have something like, hey, there's a cathedral that does this like crazy, you know, sunbeams through the stained glass effect. Nothing has quite that impact. But I feel like in every area, there are multiple spaces where, you know, aside from like, hey, here is 3 long screens of forest and you're walking in a straight line and there's skeletons. There's some of those. But other than that, I feel like there's there, you know, there's just lots of little details, like the way things are structured and laid out, you know, everything from like, here is a random room that has a waterfall in it, and you have to figure out how to work your way through the waterfall. And there's got to be something up there that's optional, right? Sure, something. What is that? Just lots of things that kind of beckon you and say, oh, yes, this is very curious. What's going on here?
I do agree that they've put more effort into the, especially the visuals in this game than they have the other ones in the DS series. But, you know, the concession is these are small levels. I did the Skeleton Cave very recently again, and I love the Skeleton Cave. It's full of skeletons. How can I not? But that's hence like, that's a 5 minute stage, you know, and then it's broken up, of course, by the map as well. So that's not going to immerse you in the same way. It doesn't give you the sense of place, as you say. So I do feel like they're juggling it there. There's more set pieces in this game as well to, I guess, take your mind off that and make you focus on what's happening now rather than what am I walking through? What am I sort of looking at? But, I mean, you are right. It does have the best sense of place, probably, of the games, which makes it something of a shame that it loses that by having you leave the place. So, yeah, go to another place so often. And again, I like that. And I wouldn't want to lose that idiosyncrasy to get the full map. I really like the idiosyncrasies it brings. But I think everyone's right. We should just have a big party. And
really like the kind of world layout of Dawn of Sorrow a lot, with the kind of town that you have to go through and then get into the castle. But yeah, like, and Portrait of Ruin is a game that has like 16 brilliant ideas that it does the first thing you would think of with and nothing else.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, like viewing Ecclesia and Bloodstained as companion pieces, because Bloodstained is Order of Ecclesia with all the Symphony of the Night stuff put in it. Like, Jeremy, I know you've famously written about how, like, the thing that we all love about Symphony of the Night is just how much stuff there is. Like, useful stuff, useless stuff, weird stuff. And Bloodstained just puts a lot of that back in. Whereas, yeah, like, there just wasn't, I don't think, like, physical room to focus on a lot of it in the GBA and DS eras.
Yeah.
I will say, Ecclesia is probably my second favorite Castlevania game. Well, probably third, because it's probably Dawn of Sorrow.
Simon's Quest.
Yeah. Dawn of Sorrow, Simon's Quest, and then Ecclesia. No, Dawn of Sorrow, Symphony of the Night, and then Ecclesia. I think all of the steps it takes towards adding in the stuff, like, you know, giving you this whole weird region, it's kind of like halfway attempt at making you have to like go back and explore different parts of it. I like the first time you go through the water level, you go through the top, and then you go through the bottom, and those areas don't connect, but they are like the first time you go through, they don't really connect, but they are part of the same thing. I think that's really cool. I like the cast of huge weirdos that are all extended members of the same family in this one village.
If it goes back far enough, it's not really the same family.
Yeah, I know, but it's like they wanted to do a thing and then they forgot that there would be additional consequences to that thing.
It's the Arkansas region of Transylvania.
Listen, we are all related, but none of us, we don't do any of that stuff.
I do want to say that I think Weigel Village is one of the best elements of this game, not just because, as someone mentioned before, it's like home base, but also because it has the villagers. And in addition to the fact that they're weirdos who have quirks and, you know, you're kind of like, what's with this person? They're not lying to you like they were in Simon's Quest. And almost all of them, I think all of them, give you quests. And that's something that the series started to explore with Portrait of Ruin, where Wind basically would give you quests. Yeah. But they were all pretty stupid. It was like, go kill 10 of this thing, go find me an object. Whereas the ones here, there's some of that, but it's also kind of puzzle-like. You know, like, I need you to go say a prayer by the sunset or something. And so you'll think, like, what does that mean? And then you realize, oh, yeah, there's a chapel, and it's always sunset there, so I need to go and pray at that chapel, and, you know, I will find something at this cross. And those quests give you reason to return to the spaces that you've been to in a generally more meaningful way than might have been the case in some of the other games. So
I mean, they're kind of
and
necessary.
You can rescue cats.
Yes, cats.
That's true. Just like Chrono Trigger.
They are kind of necessary in this game because without doing the quests, you really don't get good items you don't get access to good items. They become a bit more sort of maybe not mandatory, but you're going to have a bad time if you don't do them. I think we're not talking about Portrait of Ruin, but making the comparison, obviously, that to me, it just tells why Portrait of Ruin is, which is just a space to do game stuff in. You know, it's a very systems-based and lacking in a lot of other areas, and I still love it to death. But Order of Ecclesia, they're trying to, again, make it more cohesive, make it make more sense. I mean, the localization of the villagers is a lot more... I don't know how to describe it. They don't talk like anyone else in any Castlevania game. It's feels a lot more colloquial, like a lot more jokey, a lot more kind of human, I'd say.
That is Tom Hewlett is the
The guy who made the medicine guy yell, "Hey there!"
He localized it, so yeah. He's the localization editor. So whatever you love about the localization, you can thank him for.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's. Again, Castlevania 2 wanted to give you NPCs with personalities, right? And unfortunately, like, you have, 36 characters in, like, a little box to get that across? And so what you get is incomprehensibility and lying. And those are the ways
to
get characters.
Well, the lying is deliberate.
Yeah. And I feel like what that's actually trying to get is what you get in Ecclesia, which is you get a bunch of huge weirdos. That do have personalities and like, oh, this lady's really nervous and forgetful and this guy is very over the top and this guy's worried. Like, I mean, it's a simple bit of characterization, but that is all you need to make something engaging. Again, it's like, it's kind of very Dragon Quest-y.
The fact as well that you are physically rescuing these people in order to populate the village and then get useful resources from them means they actually have a purpose rather than just like being a menu, which is also cool, I think.
Yeah.
Although hiding some of them behind breakable walls was a dick move. They should have done that.
Yeah, for sure.
Very curious to know how all of these people get past the Undertaker.
He's got that shovel. I can never dodge that shovel. Like, it had a hitbox.
Maybe he just doesn't care about civilians. He's just after the people with glyphs.
The people who are dead bodies. More dead bodies. I am the Undertaker.
All right, turn around. You got any back tattoos? All right. We didn't know that Shinoha was Yakuza all this time. The Dragon of Dojima.
I guess the dragon. Doesn't Dracula mean dragon?
Little dragon.
Yeah, the dragon. Order of the dragon.
Draculette.
Dracul.
Oof. A single Dracule.
It's a measurement in metric.
So there are some other characters worth mentioning in this. Shinoha, we've kind of talked about because she's the main character. She's having a rough time of things. The game begins. She thinks, oh, I'm going to be the heir to this cool organization. I'm going to be the next one to fight Dracula. I'm going to save the world. And then she's like, everything is stolen from her, her powers, her memory, etc. And so she has to figure out what's going on while saving the world, while not having any powers and basically being this tiny, weak little infant trying to fight giant floppy skeletons and so forth. It's rough. But there are some other characters. There's Albus. There's Barlow. Someone put a plus after Barlow in the notes. Is that, is
I noticed
that intentional?
The plus. Barlow game plus.
That's, yeah, so you finish Barlow. You can restart him.
Nice.
It's raising the bar from sorry.
I mean, really, those are kind of the only other two characters of note, but they're important. Albus is kind of looks like, oh crap, I totally blanked on his name from Final Fantasy XII.
Oh, I almost said Bartholomew. Balthazar. Balthier.
Balthier, yes. Hangs out with Fran.
Hangs out with Fran. How could you?
He's Han Solo to her Chewbacca. Yeah, I mean, he's got the same kind of look. And I guess that was confusing to me because he's Albus. And then, like, the sort of mentor over both of them is Barlow, which is kind of Balthier-esque in terms of a name. So yeah. That was, and Final Fantasy XII was, like, 2 years before this came out. So kind of working in a mode there, I guess. Albus is, he's the other playable character in this. Once you beat the game, you can do the new game plus mode or, like, the alternate mode. So you can play as Albus if you want. And he has a gun and also can use glyphs. And I guess he can use, like, gun glyphs or something.
Yeah,
it's a little fuzzy to me.
He has a gun with a bunch of different attacks, and he can teleport around the screen when you tap the bottom screen, which is fun.
How do they do that in the Dominus collection?
You have to use, like, the mouse or the right stick and the right trigger. It's really awful.
Yeah,
at least it's there, you know.
Actually, how do they do the Portrait of Rune bonus mode with the sisters?
Oh, it's, good question. It's not good. It's not very good. It's pretty much twin stick.
It's actually fun on the DS. Like, I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I like sisters mode more than the main game, honestly.
That's the thing I wanted to ask you. Like, do you guys like those other modes? Like, do you guys?
I like the sisters. I'm not really big in the others. But
nobody likes
good.
Axe armor mode from Portrait of Rune. I need to be obvious. I like Julius mode in Dawn of Sorrow because it's a whole fleshed out thing with a new story and a new final boss.
I probably
like it more than the main game, which I also love.
You do get kind of more story content when you do the sisters as well. Like, not like, you know, a lot, but you do get like a scene with Wind and the twins.
And then I get a very sore thumb from holding the DS in one hand. And, I think that Albus mode it is fun, but I think it's probably the weakest of the extra modes, given that it doesn't have any kind of, not to spoil it, but I think you just go and fight yourself in it. It's weird. it's not that it's not fun, because the main game is great. It's just a bonus mode, but it's a little bit of a shame coming off, Dawn of Sorrow with a single tremendous bonus mode in Julius mode, which is like so good. Like, they could have sold that by itself and I would have loved it. And then Portrait of Rune, which is, as mentioned, it's just them going, hey, check out all of our stuff. There's like five bonus modes. They're like Richter and Maria, whatever. Who cares? Who gives a shit? Let's go.
like the Richter and Maria mode, who cares? But the sisters mode is really fun just because it's so weird and so different.
Yeah.
And it really plays around with the stylus element in a way that no other Castlevania did. And it's not like, oh, we have to do stylus, draw a seal on the screen, thank you. It's actually like your characters are controlled entirely with a stylus, and each of them has different skills. And there's all kinds of weird physics effects with some of the enemies. So it's just fun to play around. Like, in the opening part of Sisters mode, when you're in the village and the zombies are coming out, like, if you attack them with the stylus, right, you're using I think Stella, who has the saber, the rapier, like you'll cause the demon, like the zombies, like their heads to fly different distances and stuff, and you can just like goof around. I made like a little mini game for myself out of that, just like how far can I get a zombie head to fly.
It wasn't hard, it was just fun. It was something to like kind of wind down with after going through Portrait.
It was just so tactile and sort of satisfying, and the way they positioned it in the game as just here's a bonus mode to sort of dick around in, I think it enhances it more, really. It's just fun. It's just popcorn, like that game is in general.
Yep.
It's fun.
Yeah. But Albus, his mode, I haven't actually spent any time playing it yet, but I can't imagine that it's good because uniquely interesting. Just because he's not that uniquely interesting a character. But Albus as a character is great because, one, he's kind of got his own thing going on. and he's kind of tempestuous and hot-headed, but also kind of scheming. Mm-hmm. So there's some layers there. But also, because if you steal his glyph during combat, it's basically the best attack through the back half of the game. And that's extremely good. So I will always forgive a kind of mediocre character or enemy who does something worthwhile to my my loadout of abilities. So God bless Albus and his crazy ball of light that destroys everything and helps you kick asses all throughout the rest of the game.
Since you mentioned it, I really love the glyph stealing thing in this game, because it's like the souls from Dawn of Sorrow, but with none of the grinding. You just have to wait for the attack. I mean, there is still some grinding, don't get me wrong, but the idea of it is just so much more dynamic, and I love that. Even the fact that if you were to capture the same one again, it gives you like attribute points. I know it's not much, but it makes it feel like everything is always worth doing. And when that's important.
Yeah, I actually find that a great thing when you attack an enemy and you can see, oh, okay, this one's going to give me a glyph if I keep at it. It adds like a real Pokemon Jiggly Ball kind of thing, like, I'm going to get it this time, aw. I'm going to get it this time, aw.
Oh, you mean the ghost glyphs that can't actually interact with? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, it's a nice touch. Placeholder, need to remember this. But also, some of the glyphs show up in really, really difficult battles. And you're so caught up in the heat of the moment trying to survive, you know, a really tough boss battle in a really tough game that it doesn't occur to you until later, like, oh, wait, they were using a glyph and I could have stolen that. So you really have to be on your toes during some of the boss battles to steal the glyphs. And that's great because not only does it give you something that may become a very valuable part of your arsenal, but also it interrupts their attack and prevents them from using it. And it kind of reminds me of the draw system in Final Fantasy VIII, where you'd go up against enemies and the bosses especially tended to have unique skills that you could pull from them. But it's not as grindy as Final Fantasy VIII. Final Fantasy VIII, you know, you're like, well, this battle with Cypher is the only time I'm going to be able to draw whatever the hell it is that Cypher has in the final encounter with Cypher. So you're just whittling away time, waiting for Cypher to... you know, for your turn to come up so you can steal magic from Cypher until everyone is topped out and then you finally kill him. That's boring. And then you don't want to use the magic because you can junction it to something and it makes your stats so good. This isn't like that. Like, it's much more practical. It's just like, hey, the enemy, they're using an attack. If I react really quickly, I can suction that glyph away and prevent them from attacking. And also, it's mine now. Mm-hmm. It's like Mega Man, but... even more dynamic.
It's really cool how it turns what is essentially...
with that, the rules of combat.
It's like, it turns like you collecting things into a viable defense as well. It's really cool. Like another cool thing to do, basically, in the fights.
Yeah, I feel like with this game, they really figured out a lot of the ideas they'd been kicking around and hadn't quite made like, oh, this is good. This is super satisfying. You know, like stealing souls in the Sorrow games. I will admit that I'm a crazy weirdo who has, the aforementioned sicko who has 100%ed the collections in both of the Sorrows games. I'm not proud of it, but I did used to ride the bus or the train back and forth to work every day. So what else are you going to do in that 30 minutes each way? But this lowers that level of grindiness and repetition significantly. And, you know, if you want to go out and you want to just steal glyphs so that you min-max, you know, your levels to ridiculous levels, that's fine. You can, but you don't have to. You can still play without doing that. Just be vigilant. Pay attention. Glyphs show up at the least expected places.
The attributes and the glyphs do also it's discouraged because you don't really need to grind, because it's not really about number go up anymore. It's about having the right weapon rather than the strongest weapon, which...
Yeah.
And a lot of the glyphs are also hidden in the worlds, usually by solving some kind of small puzzle or clearing a little platforming challenge or something. And it just makes it all more dynamic and much less walk into room, kill enemy, didn't drop it, walk out the room, walk back into the room, kill enemy, didn't drop it, repeat literally 900 times because they got the numbers wrong when they were making the game and they don't drop them enough.
On the subject of like finding glyphs in weird places, I do really like the idea in the first half of the game where there are glyphs that are like incorporated into something in the world, like the one that shoots electric sparks and the one that's at the top of the lighthouse.
The lighthouse is pretty clever.
It's a cool,
like,
cool idea.
I really wish they would have done more with that idea, because I feel like that is a... That raises a lot of questions, if you think about it for a second, of like, okay, are all light bulbs powered by magic glyphs that come
just
from
the really, really strong ones that keep you from crashing into rocks?
Yeah. Also, how many people died, Shinoa?
Yeah.
Because you wanted to cast Luminato.
She killed Jason off and countless screaming Argonauts.
Shinoa dooming the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Gordon Lightfoot's like grabbing his guitar saying, all right, as he runs down to the shore.
It's the secret 16th verse of that song is about Shinoa.
They do a good job of integrating the glyph system, not just into combat and the world, but also into the story here, which I feel like is a kind of a Final Fantasy trick. I keep going back to Final Fantasy, but I feel like Order of Ecclesia is the most Final Fantasy of all the Castlevanias, if we have to get down to it. You know, the Final Fantasy games, except maybe 16, I haven't bothered to play it, but they always, you know, they have these systems, eidolons or espers or whatever, crystals.
Summons, yeah.
Yeah. And they're always integrated into the story, but also integrated into the combat system. And the glyphs are very much about that because, you know, they're what locks away the villagers. You have to rescue the villagers from Albus's glyphs. Spoilers. And that's the only way you can reach the true end game is by rescuing all the villagers. But also the way you actually reach the final battle is by acquiring glyphs from a certain character. And then before that, you have to get, you know, the Dominus glyph, which is kind of what they named the recent collection after. That's how important it is. So it's, you know, it's just this element where it feels like, in addition to, like, it's classic Metroidvania, in addition to helping you navigate the world, it's also empowering you. And that's good.
Is it Dominus because it's the DS game?
That I was going to say.
Oh, damn.
That
wasn't actually in the title, though. So I think they just called it Dominus because it's the coolest thing in the collection.
That's why it's the first one on the menu when you boot it up.
But all those games, like all that, those first flock of DS games did have that title structure. Dawn of Sorrow, for instance. But
Dual Strike, Dragon Sword, yeah.
Dream Drop Distance. I guess that was that 3DS?
That was 3DS, that was 3DS,
yeah.
Oh, that's clever. I just got that.
Yeah.
It's not clever.
Yeah.
It's a Kingdom Hearts title. It's not
very clever. Excuse you.
Nothing about Kingdom Hearts game titles is clever. They are.
I'm absolutely not.
They are aggressive. They are an aggressive, hateful.
Really sounds like you're tied up with some kind of chain of memories there, Jeremy. Yeah. Like, I think maybe you need to break out of that.
I mean, I could talk about this for 358 days.
This is where I'm breaking to have some sea salt ice cream.
I'm going to find an excuse to make Kingdom Hearts Metroidvania now. I'll find
a
way.
What?
To make you play it. I'll find a way to justify it as a Metroidvania.
That might be the one I skip.
My friends keep telling me this should be the year that I get into Kingdom Hearts. And I'll tell you, if there was a Metroidvania, that would be the way to do it.
It is a well from which there is no escape.
That sounds like a threat, actually.
Those games fun.
Are those games fun? There's any difficult question. How sane are you?
I mean, I am a full sicko, so.
But only for Metroidvanias.
Okay. I mean, this is not the place for me to answer that question, really, but I'm just going to say, yeah, they're the most fun games in the world, Chris. Get it playing.
All right.
I think you should do some Kingdom Hearts podcasts, Stuart, and
will do.
Don't invite me onto them.
Okay. I'm not going to invite you. There was no question of inviting. I'm just going to, you know, this is not going to be a voluntary thing.
Show up at my house
thing.
One day.
Yeah. Hey.
Hello, Jeremy. We're recording now.
It's Mickey time.
No, Dad, no. Sorry, old meme.
Mickey time also sounds like a threat.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So there's more that we could say about Order of Ecclesia, and we will in the next episode. So I think this is a good kind of natural place for us to break now that we're talking about Kingdom Hearts for some reason.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. Like, to me, that says we've kind of hit like a stopping point. And we need to have many, many sleeps and refresh our brains and attack the topic anew with fresh vigor and excitement. So this is where I put it over to you, the listener, to catch up and then go ahead and play the rest of the game, because next episode we're talking about Dracula's castle. And we're going to talk about the other bits and pieces of the game we did not discuss. And we are going to field your comments and feedback as seen in Discord. So if you are a Retronauts patron, patreon.com/retronauts, who has access to the Discord, we will be collating responses there. I guess we'll probably launch a new channel in the Discord to coincide with the launch of this episode. And feel free to share your thoughts there. Play the game. Spoil away. I would say it's an all spoilers zone. No need to mark spoilers. We just assume if you are playing through this game, you're invested in it and you're there for it. So maybe skip that channel until you're done. But then once you're done, or once you don't care about spoilers, leave some thoughts. Like, what do you think about Castlevania Order of Ecclesia? Am I correct? I'm correct. In that the world map should be contiguous because that would be a much better game. Yes. But also, what do you think of Shinoa? What do you think of the glyph system? What's your favorite part of the castle? And so on and so forth. Any thoughts? It's all open season, fair game. Go for it. Participate. If you're not a Retronauts patron, this is a good opportunity and a good excuse for you to rectify that grievous error that you've made in judgment. So head over to patreon.com/retronauts. In addition to being able to participate in the next episode of Metroidvania Book Club, you will also be able to do things like hear exclusive episodes and read exclusive columns and so on and so forth. It's very good. You will not regret it. It's great. We're great. You're great. We're all great. And Castlevania Order of Ecclesia is great. So hop on and tell us what you think. In the meantime, we are going to sign off. I continue to be Jeremy Paris, just as I was at the beginning of this episode. And you can find me on the internet on Blue Sky as jparish.bluesky.social. You can find me here on Retronauts. You can find me on YouTube as Jeremy Paris. And you can find me, if you buy certain limited run products, such as the Castlevania Dominus Collection, if you pre-ordered that, the Collector's Edition, cool. You get some very, very, very time-consuming, intricate maps for all three of those games, including this one. Very proud of it. Which you guys see the castle side of the map? It's so good. Like, when you lay that castle out, chef's kiss. Beautiful. Looking forward to sharing that with everyone. Now let's see. Kate, you've been kind of quiet for the past half hour. Hopefully we haven't driven you away or caused you to become disinterested in the conversation, but please tell us where we can find you online and more of your thoughts on Metroidvania and what it means to be a Metroidvania sicko.
Well, my last name's kind of difficult to spell, so if you just search for Critical Kate on Blue Sky or Google or YouTube, you will probably find some of my stuff. I am... what else should I say? I'm working on a video still about the origin of the word Metroidvania that is relevant. Things keep getting in my way, preventing me from doing it, like some sort of Castlevania boss, but I will persevere and it will happen one of these days.
Let's see, Chris, you talked this episode. Very, very excited about that.
Even though my voice is all weird and messed up from being ill this week.
You get that kind of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. sound to you. No? Okay, maybe not. It just sounds
That's
sick.
A look. You just got a look, Jeremy.
I'm not comparing you to him.
That's the real sicko. But yes, I'm Chris Sims, and you can hear me on several episodes of Retronauts, as well as on my own podcast, including War Rocket Ajax, the weekly comic book and pop culture podcast that has a Patreon associated with it. And if you are a $5 backer of that Patreon, you will get access to a series of Metroidvania reviews that I have written that is currently 14 parts deep. I have not yet written about anything in the Dominus collection, but I have written about Symphony of the Night, Super Metroid, Axiom Verge, Toho Luna Knights, an unexpected favorite of mine, Bloodstained, Vigil, and the Castlevania Advance Collection, which includes the previous set of games. They're a bunch of increasingly weird reviews. My favorite one is the one of Hollow Knight, which I think is a very fun read. Do enjoy those and find me at my website, the-isb.com, or on Blue Sky as theisb.bluesky.social.
All right, Stuart Jip, we can't see you on the call, but we know you're here, like the Holy Spirit.
I'm sorry, I have camera issues. I should really get a proper camera at some point, but then you'd all see me and it would be just exponentially worse. Hello, yes, you can mostly find me on Retronauts, actually. I think that if you're listening to this, you might already have known that, but it couldn't hurt to hear it again. I also wrote a book called All Games Are Good. It's actually an excellent book. I mean, I'm unbiased when I say that, but I think it's very good fun. I think you'd like it. And you can get it from Limited Run Games, or you can get it from Amazon, but you should probably get it from Limited Run. And also, I'm pretty sure I'm not sure if it still will be by the time this goes out, but it's, the paperback is, I think it's half off at the moment, isn't it? It's quite cheap at the moment.
Yes, just the paperback.
This wasn't discussed with me, by the way.
Yes, it was.
Yes, I'm sure it was discussed. But either way, the more people get a copy of this book, the better.
And finally, Nadia.
Hi, I'm on Retronauts a lot here, too, as well. But when I'm not retronauting, I am the co-host of the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. We talk about RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western. Please support us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod, where we are not only doing podcasts, we're doing a lot of streaming, and I am doing a newsletter for the $5 tier and above, and I just kind of write little essays and stuff about, like, what's going on in RPGs, and sometimes some retro stuff. Like, I actually wrote a kind of retrospective, a quick one, about Evo, Search for Eden, which is a real strange RPG, but that has some, like, just a great base in it for whatever may come in the future. And yeah, find me on Blue Sky at Naughty Oxford.
And I think that's everything. So we will turn it over to you. Please, everyone, go out and play Castlevania Order of Ecclesia, whether that's on DS or through the Dominus Collection or however you choose to play. We won't judge. Just play it. It's good times. And hop on to the Discord. And in like a few weeks, we'll record another episode, round it up and round up your comments and put a stake through it, as they say.